Thank you all. Michael, I'm delighted to be here. I'm always pleased to be in this building and pleased to be with you and honor as I can the work that you do. I asked the general counsel earlier if the bagpipes preceded him everywhere, and he said no, but it wouldn't be a bad idea. So maybe we'll see that the next time you're here or the next time you're anywhere else. Thank you for your comments about our economic relationships together, our foreign policy relationships together, the intelligence relationships we have are unique in the world. And as the person who gets to sit every day in an office that was once used by Harry Truman, that's certainly the memories of what happened at Fulton and the importance of that visit by Winston Churchill, incredibly important to know. Always good to see Monsignor Kerwicki here. I decided over the last few days thinking about the fact that he's sort of the General Assembly's answer to Sister Jean. So a little younger than Sister Jean, but not as prescient in determining what's going to happen, maybe, as Sister Jean. And, Monsignor Kerwicki mentioned this is the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King. And I think it's important to take a couple of minutes here and just think about that, the difference that one life can make. Martin Luther King was 25 or 26 when he and his new family, his young family, moved to Montgomery, Alabama to become the pastor of the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church. When the bus boycott began, all of the senior pastors at the African-American churches in Montgomery had relationships with leaders in the community and the newspaper and other things, and they knew that Martin Luther King didn't have those relationships yet, so they turned to him and said, why don't you lead the bus boycott? Why don't you lead the bus boycott in your mid-20s and your first year in Montgomery? And then 13 years later, Dr. King is assassinated. The night before he's killed, he gets out of a sick bed and gives a speech in Memphis, and in that speech says that he can see the goal, he believes we will get to the goal, but he said, I may not get there with you. Most people at 39 don't think that they may not get to a goal that others in the room will get to, but he did. And you know, there's going to be a lot of discussion in the last few days and the next few days about Dr. King, but it's really a good time to think about the importance of life, the value of life, and the difference that one committed life can make. And I think with the speaker's indulgence, I'm going to suggest we just take a few moments here of silence and think about all those issues, particularly about Dr. King. Thank you for allowing me that privilege. You know, I think when we think about some of the challenges of life that others have faced, the things that we get pretty wrapped around don't seem nearly as big as they do when we're just thinking about a sense of our own problems rather than the challenges other people face. The process that you are involved in, that I'm involved in for you in Washington, wasn't designed to be easy. Both the federal constitution was designed by people who didn't trust the government and didn't want the government to get to any easy conclusion. Our state constitutions have generally followed that, and we prove in incredible ways how difficult it can be to get things done. But that's what democracy is all about. You know, if you get everything you want, very often there must be something wrong. Things just don't happen exactly like any of us would like them to happen. In a democracy, and you're part of that. You're coming to where you can begin to see the end of the session and all the decisions that have to be made for the government to continue and to do the things it needs to do. I do think we have reason to be optimistic as a country right now and reason to be optimistic in our state. I've mentioned to you before the big economic driver that I think we'll see in what's going to happen with world food demand. It'll double between now and 2050. Nobody is better at this than we are as a country, and frankly, nobody in the country is better positioned than we are to take advantage of that unbelievable opening of a marketplace that only some cataclysmic disaster will prevent. This is one of the more easy things to project and to decide, do we want to be part of this or not? I think there's going to be more and more interest in bringing manufacturing jobs back to the United States and increasing the manufacturing opportunities we have now. You know, we always do better. Our state does better. The middle of the country always does better in an economy that focuses on growing and making things. We are a productive people. We don't do quite as well in the giving advice economy. There's nothing wrong with the giving advice economy, but it needs to be underpinned by an economy that produces things. And if you're going to be thinking about where to produce those things, where to create those jobs, we would want that to be right here. And if you're going to bring manufacturing jobs to America today or increase what you're doing in America today, the first two questions you would ask would be, can you pay the electric bill and still do what you want to do? And does the transportation system work for what you want to make or grow? And if the answer to either of those things is no, there's no reason to go to the third question, which is who has the best workforce that we can afford and that will want to stay where we've brought these jobs. All three of those things, frankly, are an important part of the responsibility here, to continue to see that the infrastructure works well, both the transportation infrastructure and the other infrastructure, to continue to see that we're not just preparing people for jobs, but we're preparing people for the kind of jobs that are out there that people need to have. One of the things we did last year in the Appropriations Committee that I chair, we went back to the year-round Pell Grant. Now, this is not a loan. Anybody that gets a Pell Grant doesn't have to pay it back, but it's need-based. And for about 10 years, we hadn't had year-round Pell. Now, why does that matter? It matters because if you're going to school on your own, and particularly if you're an adult returning back to school, anything you do that disrupts the pattern that's working minimizes, it makes it less likely that you'll actually graduate. In the 10 years of no year-round Pell, people who had everything working but couldn't afford to go to school in the summer because they couldn't pay the tuition would say, okay, I'm gonna work full-time this summer and I'll be back in the fall. And often what happened, you get to the fall and you think, well, I need to do this full-time work a little longer. I'll be back in January. And before you know it, life gets in the way and you just don't graduate. So returning to getting that work done as quickly as you can, and also expanding Pell. But let me first mention getting it done. There is no community college in our state where if you qualify for year-round Pell doesn't, or full Pell rather, the full grant, Pell Grant in any community college in our state pays full tuition, pays for the books, and pays the fees. So free education for those first 2 years in terms of what the government provides. Several of our four-year schools, if you qualify for year-round Pell, you have the same benefit. The president of the University of Missouri announced recently that beginning in the fall, if you qualify for year-round for full Pell, and you can get admitted to the University of Missouri Columbia, that's all the tuition you pay. Now, that's about as good as a state system can do to encourage people who otherwise wouldn't be able to go to school to go to school at an institution like the University of Missouri or the other places we have that do that. The transportation system, I was at Chris Chen, the Director of Agriculture, who, by the way, I think is doing a great job, and Blake Hurst, the President of the Farm Bureau, and I were at the panel at an ag forum at Missouri State University a week ago, and we had 45 minutes of questions and answers. Not a single question was about the next farm bill. Every single question was about rural broadband, transportation, and regulation. Those things that you can have real impact on and I can have real impact on broadband, 31% of rural Americans don't have access to broadband, 51% of rural Missourians don't have access to broadband. We need to do something about that. Broadband is going to be just as important over the next 50 years as the telephone was over the last 50 years. And this needs to be a partnership. There's no reason we should not be behind in creating an opportunity, not just for people to work and live where they want to live, but the disadvantage of kids at school, some of which have access to everything they need at night, at home in terms of information, and others don't. People who work and want to live in rural Missouri should be able to do that, and you and I should be thinking about this. I think the broadband, the transportation, the regulation environment in the country is much better than it was 2 or 3 years ago. I think not that we don't need regulation, it's just we don't need regulation that produce more problems than they solve and create obstacles to opportunity. The tax bill, I think, was a great step in the right direction to make us, Council General, more economically competitive and to make Missouri and America a place where you want to put more jobs that are going to compete all over the world. In our system, I just was talking to the governor's staff today, and of the 53,000 state employees in Missouri, this first quarter of the year, 8.1 million fewer dollars will go to Washington than did last year. That also means 8.1 million dollars will stay in our state that last year went to Washington, D.C. Those things that make a difference for families, 9 out of 10 people that paid income taxes last year will pay fewer income taxes this year. If you're a single parent and you make $41,000, and many single parents would have to have a couple of jobs to do that, but if you're a single parent and you make $41,000, you're going to get a 70% tax deduction, tax reduction this year. You're going to have $130 more every month of your money to spend on you and your child than you would have had last year. If two of you work and you make $73,000 and you have two children, you're going to have $2,000 more of your money to spend this year than you had last year. Now, there are some people clearly in Washington who think $130 or $200 a month doesn't matter. Let me tell you, it matters if you don't have it. It matters if you don't have it. And families are beginning to see that that works for them. The one thing that I had not anticipated was the response of employers in a growing economy to quickly send the message they want to keep the employees they have. I said on the U.S. Senate floor several times during this debate, there are two ways to increase people's take-home pay. One is for the government to take less out of the check that they already have earned, and two is a growing economy that produces better jobs and more competition for the workforce. I think we've seen number two happen quicker than I thought it would, in terms of people giving bonuses, announcing that they're going to begin to raise their entry-level salaries because they think the economy is going to grow and they want to keep the employees that they have. Workforce preparation, everything from summer jobs to year-round Pell. And by the way, on the Pell, we also changed the Pell grants to where they don't just apply to colleges and universities, but also apply to certificated programs. That if the program is designed in a way, a trade program, an apprentice program, you can qualify for that post-high school assistance just like you could college. We need to be sure we're preparing people for the jobs that are available. Opioids, another area that I'm working on a lot and you're going to be hearing a lot about and are hearing a lot about. You know, this is the opioid addiction is the number one cause of accidental death in our state and in the country today. More people die from overdose than die from car accidents. And this is a problem that has been growing and growing and growing, and we have to do something about it, and we will. First thing we're going to do is exactly what we did last year, which is give a lot of flexibility to states like ours to take the money that they're receiving to figure out how to deal with this and come up with a plan that will work. Not every plan can be designed or should be designed in Jefferson City, and you should be asking about this, seeking information on it, talking about how the whole system is encouraging people to reach the right conclusions about their addiction, but also ensuring that we help them beat that addiction. Most people that are addicted to opioids didn't get addicted through bad behavior. They got addicted through pain medicine that was actually prescribed for them by a doctor or a dentist. And we're going to have to be much more careful about the size of that prescription and how many pills you're allowed to take home, and also determining the real pain issues in the country. Until just a couple of years ago, the federal government asked in their hospital survey, did you have any pain while you were in the hospital? Well, obviously that was not the right question, because it was also pretty obvious what the answer was supposed to be, as opposed to, did you have acceptable pain when you were in the hospital? Did you have any unacceptable pain? Did you have any pain you didn't understand? Doctors and dentists and others were assured for years by the teaching schools of medicine and dentistry and pharmacy that this was not addictive, and it turns out that was wrong. So we're going to be working on that. And another thing I'm going to mention to you that I'm particularly pleased we're part of is this expansion in a bill that Senator Stabenow, a Democrat from Michigan, and I got passed, Excellence in Mental Health. We have 200 locations in our state right now where mental health is being treated like all other health. That is what we should have always have done. We are way behind in this, but our state has really been pretty forward-leaning on this issue. And I think what we're going to find out in these eight big state pilots, that when you treat people's mental health problems the way they need to be treated, that their other health problems are so much more easily dealt with that it doesn't even cost anything to do the right thing. But that's one of the things we're trying to determine. The National Institute of Health says that one out of four adult Americans has a diagnosable and almost always treatable mental health issue. This is not something that you and I don't know people who are dealing with it every day. One out of nine adult Americans have a mental health issue that impacts how they live every day. And our state, 24 states applied, our state was one of the eight states that had the best plan to move forward with the greatest availability of looking at mental health. We're also, by the way, doing really well in health research generally. Not only have we made a commitment to make that a priority at the federal level, but the University of Missouri, St. Louis University, Washington University, in cancer, in Alzheimer's, in our children's hospitals, and pediatric cancer and heart problems are doing great research. And I think that also is going to be one of the big economic drivers. Healthcare is going to change in a revolutionary way, and it's one of the things we also want to be at the front of instead of trailing behind. I would just say thanks for what you do. You know, if everything's a priority, nothing is a priority. Very few people come to your office or my office and suggest that we do something bad. There are a lot of great ideas out there, but your job and my job is to try to figure out how to prioritize those ideas so that what needs to get done gets done, and it gets done in the best possible way. Thank you for being part of that. Thank you for letting me work for you, and thank you for letting me be with you today. Thank you all.